When I was growing up, it was me and my laddie. I'm a big collie named after Lassie, except, of course, Laddie was a boy. And then it was me and my Bonnie, a somewhat crazy golden retriever mix who lived with us when I was in high school and college. And then my husband and I adopted Sparky, a Cocker Spaniel, and Puff, a Springer Spaniel. And now it is me and my lady, an Australian Shepherd mix. I loved all of the dogs in my life, and there were more, and I'm sure you have too. They all had different personalities and different habits. We will talk about how we can be a better friend to our best canine friends this hour, and we will welcome your stories and your questions for our guest expert. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, May the 16th. Our guest says that man's best friend is not a wolf in disguise, and says we need to change the way we think of dogs, not as animals that need to be dominated, but as social companions who emotionally depend on humans. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a thought or a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm happy to welcome our guest, John Bradshaw, Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. He is the author of the book, Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is it that we need to change about the way we think about dogs?
Well, I think the fundamental change has happened over probably about 10 years now, ever since the wolf biologists began to revise their ideas of how wolves actually saw each other and constructed their family lives. I think that hasn't really caught up, or at least the science of dog training hasn't really entirely caught up with that change. And the change is that the wolf biologists now think of wolves as essentially family animals, that they live in family groups, parents and adult offspring and the young offspring, and that the whole thing is not ruled and controlled and regulated by aggression. It's essentially a voluntary joining together of family members.
Hmm.
The younger adults stay there because they want to, not because they are scared of their parents. When two families of wolves meet up, it's a very different story. They are quite aggressive towards one another. But the underlying idea of wolf social life now is thought to be a family bond based on affection. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the first lesson that needs to get through to the whole craft of dog training.
So my dog lady does not view me as an alpha dog?
Well, I think what we'd now say is that alpha is kind of a redundant term, that an alpha in a wolf situation is just the parent. So if you wanted to translate that into your dog thinks of you as a parental figure, then I think that's not too far off the mark. I mean, we dogs know the difference between dogs and people. There's no doubt about that. But they have this wonderful, almost unique capacity to form social bonds with two species, at least, I mean, certainly with people and with dogs at the same time, and regard both, while separate and distinct, as family members.
Mm-hmm. So if we would change the way we think about wolves being a family of animals rather than a pack ruled by some sort of violence or dominance, how would that change the way we train our dogs?
Well, I think much of the training that is done right across Europe and the United States, as far as I can gather, is done nowadays using a reward-based system. I mean, those rewards can be, they can be food, but they can equally well be contact with a human being. I mean, many of our military dogs, the kind of the area where you'd think perhaps that discipline and so on was most important, many of our military dogs in both sides of the Atlantic are now trained with play as the primary reward for finding the improvised explosive device or whatever it might happen to be, rather than this idea that if the dog is only going to work if it's slightly scared of you. So I think if the military have come as far as thinking that the best way to train a dog is by encouraging that and using that bond between the dog and the handler, then I think so should the, you know, why should the average dog owner not embrace that concept as well?
Yeah, but we still see popular shows like, well, let's say The Dog Whisperer, where he's not violent with the dogs, but he still uses that that alpha training.
Well, I think there's kind of two aspects to the alpha training idea. One is I think it's one that anyone who wanted to encourage responsible dog ownership would support, which is that dogs need to be under control. I'm certainly not advocating a kind of laissez-faire, let the dog do what it wants attitude, because that's not good for the owner and the relationship, because the dog will be a nuisance. And it's not good for the dog, because the dog may well run out in traffic or something like that, or may simply be such a nuisance that the owner eventually decides that they can't live with it anymore and takes it to the pound. So a lax relationship with a dog, in the same way as an uncontrolled relationship with a child, is not in anybody's best interest. So if you're using the term the alpha approach to say the human needs to be in control, then I would 100% support that. I think where I diverge from, and many trainers now would diverge from some of the people using the old-fashioned techniques based on the wolf, is that you don't have to evoke this idea of the wolf being, controlling through aggression. You don't indeed need to control your dog through aggression. In fact, the research, which is basically what my book is about, it's about the research that's been done over the last 10 years, and there's a huge amount of it, and it's very exciting. But the research says that if the average everyday owner uses these punishment type of techniques, check chains, electric shock collars, picking the dog up by the scruff of its neck and shaking it, all those things, then the dog is less likely to be obedient in the long term and more likely to show behavioral disorder, which needs treatment at a veterinary surgery. So I think punishment has its place I wouldn't rule it out in very extreme circumstances, but physical punishment, I mean. But for the average dog owner with a dog which is reasonably well behaved to begin with, you can much more easily train it with reward than you can with punishment. And it lasts much longer as well.
I wanted to ask you about it's a YouTube video that is went viral about a month or so ago, and it was entitled "Denver, Our Guilty Dog." And it was a dog who apparently got into some food that he shouldn't have gotten into while the family was away from the home. And the video shows this this big yellow lab at first looking very guilty when the owner says on videotape, "Did you eat these cat treats?" And the dog is looking very submissive and very guilty. Is Denver really feeling guilt at this point?
Well, the research that's been done by a colleague of mine, Alexandra Horowitz, who works from New York, a very neat piece of research that showed that while the dog, it's very easy to interpret the dog as looking guilty, and I guess, before I started studying dogs, I would have said the same thing. The dog is actually displaying is anxiety, and we interpret it as guilt. And the experiment that was done was essentially that the dogs in that experiment were in their own apartments with their owners, and the owner was told, taken out of the room and told that the dog had done something wrong while the owner was not there, and then brought back in again. Now, some of these dogs were actually given some food they'd been told not to take. The other dogs had not been allowed to take the food. Whether or not the dog had actually done the wrong thing was irrelevant to its behavior. So basically what the dog is showing is that when the owner comes back and scolds it, it doesn't really understand why it's being scolded. And so it shows some behavior which would normally kind of calm the owner down and get the owner affectionate again. And eventually it works, because the owner's punishment obviously doesn't go on for very long. But the dog has no idea. We've no evidence, and the science is now pointing in exactly the opposite direction, that the dog does not know what it's done wrong. It knows it's done something wrong, from its owner's tone of voice, but it doesn't know what. And I think that it's very important to realize that we can't punish dogs for things they've done even 5 minutes ago, let alone 2 hours ago, because they don't get it. They don't understand it.
Yeah, and maybe a more common example of humans punishing a dog for something that happened while they're away is the accident in the house, so to speak. You know, the dog pees in the house. The dog does not realize why it is being yelled at when a dog is being yelled at for doing that.
No, all the science now says the dog really doesn't know. It knows that there's something wrong. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's intelligent enough for that. But dog's sense of time is very different to ours. It's quite. I mean, I couldn't describe it to you, because I think only a dog could. But in detail. But their sense of past and future, it must be very different to ours. And they live essentially in the present, in much more than we do, which are kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time. I don't think they worry about things in the way that we do, and they don't worry about the future, I don't think, at all. So they're kind of missing some of the things that plague humans. But it does mean that they are a bit limited when it comes to understanding what we want from them, and we need to just take that into account. Once you understand that, I think it's very easy to work out how to proceed. And in the dog's best interest.
Yeah. So what would be a better approach than, you know, yelling as you're pointing at a spot in the carpet?
Well, I think the first thing, I mean, I'm not a clinician, so I'm going to give you it could be a clinical problem. And that's the first thing I should point out to anybody listening, really, is that a dog that used to be housebroken and appears to lose it, there could be a medical problem, and a veterinarian ought to become involved. But assuming it's not that, that the dog is housebroken and then you leave it and it's not sick, but it then makes a mess in the house, that is probably due to an anxiety problem. And this is the other side of the idea that dogs are really domesticated. The domestication of the dog has made the dog very powerful attraction, mainly humans, very powerfully attractive to dogs, and they learn to love people very, very easily. Of course, the flip side of that is if you leave them alone, and from what I've just said, dogs have this very poor sense of time. They don't really understand, they can't really predict whether you're coming back or not. So many dogs get very anxious in that situation. The work we've done and others have done suggests that it may be half the dogs in the Western world experience that for at least several weeks or months of their lives, and some of them for much of their lives. So this is a big, big problem. It's unavoidable in the sense that, you know, if they didn't love us that much, then they wouldn't be so much fun. So we can't get rid of that. What we can do, though, is train the dog to be left alone. And so, the old idea, prevention is better than cure, is it's definitely true here. You can train a dog very easily to cope with being left alone, but you need to do it from day one.
On Facebook, Mary Beth writes, when Wolf, her dog, was almost potty trained, he woke me up in the middle of the night a couple of times, led me downstairs, and showed me where he had an accident. He stood in the doorway, head and tail down. That wasn't shame and guilt?
No, I don't think... it's very unlikely, but dogs are very sensitive to what we want them to do, and so while I don't think the dog was feeling guilt in the way that a human would do, they are very sensitive to our to what we've done. They'll learn in a few minutes very often something that they know we would love, or they suspect that we would like them to do, and so that dog is probably just responding to knowing that it should go out the door and trying to get out, maybe failing to wake the person in time, and then just continuing to try and get out of the door.
Our guest is John Bradshaw. He is the author of Dog Sense: How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. And we're talking about that new science of dog behavior, and we're welcoming your questions and your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6 this afternoon. After 5, Ben and his guest will discuss the world's oldest game. It's the blame game, coming up after 5 o'clock. Why we blame. That's Ben's topic between 5 and 6 this afternoon. We're talking about our best friends, our dogs, with the author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. John Bradshaw is with us, and I'm wondering, John Bradshaw, are we good friends to our pets? Do our dogs consider us their best friends?
The science now says basically that the vast majority of dogs consider us their best friends. That's not to say they're born with that. You have to bring it out in them. It's something that they develop over particularly the first 6 months of their lives, almost from the minute their eyes open and through to 6 to 9 months old. They need lots of positive experiences with people and also with different kinds of people. So a dog that's raised exclusively by women may find being with men or children somewhat uncomfortable, for example. And they also need to learn about the environment we live in too. They don't have an instinctive idea of that, particularly the kind of machines we have, the cars, the dishwashers, the vacuum cleaners, and so on. They can all be scary to a dog that meets them for the first time, unless they've been introduced gently when the dog was still a puppy. If you can do all of those things, and obviously some of that is going to be the breeder, because we're starting off when the puppy's still pretty helpless with the mother. And then the owner, once you take the puppy on, if those are both got right, then the dog will be pretty resilient. It'll be a confident dog, and it will have formed this very powerful bond with people. Now there's obviously some unfortunate times when that bond goes, when the dog has to be given up to a pound, or goes to a pound, or gets given up for rehoming. And again, the research we've done has shown that this is not a permanent problem. The dog is very stressed by losing that attachment figure, mm-hmm. as you might imagine. But it has a strategy of finding a new attachment figure. And we've actually measured how fast that attachment can form. It can form in as little as 30 minutes. And it's quite extraordinary how fast it is. And it just shows the strength of the motivation of that dog to find a new human group, human pack, if you like, to live in.
Oh, that's amazing. And why sometimes a dog might form that attachment with one human in a family more so than the other family members? What's going on there?
Well, we know that dogs are very attentive to who likes them and who's kind of less. So in a family, there have been studies where, dogs have been watched interacting with their families. And once the researchers have been able to work out that maybe the husband is less dog orientated than the wife, you then notice that the dog really doesn't pay very much attention to the husband. The dog's kind of worked out that that's the husband is not very important, doesn't necessarily dislike him. And of course, it could be the other way around before I'm right. accused of being sexist about this. But whoever it is, the person who responds best to the dog is the one that the dog will respond best to and pay the most attention to. They're very, very sensitive to this. They're sensitive in a way that, as far as we know, no other animal, literally no other animal on the planet is.
Are we making a mistake when we sometimes treat dogs as fuzzy humans?
Well, it can be taken too far, I think. I don't think dogs mind a lot of things that we think they might do. I was talking on the radio last week with a couple of guys somewhere in the States, one of whom had dressed his dog up for Halloween and was being taken to task by the other presenter for having done that. He said, "You've embarrassed your dog by dressing it up." And I'm going, so I said, "No, I don't think dogs really care about that. You know, you put them in clothes. As long as they don't get too hot, they don't really know what's going on. I don't think other dogs would be too worried about it either." If you want to get a little dog that you can carry around, again, you know, that's fine. Those dogs, provided they're healthy, not all those little toy dogs, unfortunately, are particularly healthy from a genetic point of view. But provided you have one that doesn't have any of these very tragic inherited diseases and is not too small and too fragile, then that's fine too. They don't seem to mind being tiny in the way that, you know, a lot of other animals do mind. They're terrorized by the big dogs. Well, the bigger animals. Now, it doesn't happen with a dog. Dogs are not very sensitive to size. So in many ways, it doesn't really matter. I think where it does start to impinge on the dog's own well-being is where it's taken too far, and the dog is treated like a little person and maybe fed too many sweet treats, gets overweight. You know, that's a health risk as it is, just as much as it is for humans. So that kind of thing can damage the dog. But the idea that you can't think love your dog because you're going to damage it, I think that's completely wrong.
We have many callers, so let me go to the phones and go first to, is it Axe in Greendale? Hello, Axe?
Max, yeah.
Max, I'm sorry.
The question is about the toilet training of pets. A kitten instinctively knows how to use a litter box. A cat doesn't, and it's just that the inconvenience of always having to let a cat outdoors. Why is it not possible that cats or dogs, rather, have an intelligence that they cannot learn the toilet training of a house pet as opposed to a cat?
Huh. So you're saying that a dog is not as smart as a cat because it won't use a litter box, Max?
Well, I don't think it has to do with intelligence. Apparently, a kitten instinctively goes to a litter box and covers. A puppy never will do that and constantly has to be let out and cannot be trained to indoor toileting.
No, well, can you shed any light on that, John Bradshaw?
Yeah, Shirley, I don't have a terribly good connection to your callers, so yeah, thank you for repeating the question. I that's a very good question. I mean, you'd think that dogs are easier to train than cats are, so why is it so much easier to litter train a cat than a dog? And the answer is basically right back in their original biology, that cats, by and large, unless they're breeding animals, and particularly males, will always bury their feces wherever they go because they're small and vulnerable, and they have their own predators. They're obviously predators themselves, but they don't want to give their locations away. So most of the time, a cat will instinctively bury what it's done so that it doesn't, the smell of that doesn't give its presence away. Dogs are bigger. I mean, the wolves, so the canids that dogs are descended from are much bigger animals. They've got fewer enemies, and so they don't need to disguise where they've been. In fact, they may actually use both urine and feces as advertisements of where they are, but the idea that you can't train a dog to defecate where you want it to and on command is wrong. You can do. It's relatively straightforward. Most people don't do it because they don't need to, but if you want to train a dog to use a litter box, you can do it perfectly easily with very standard reward-based training techniques. I mean, I'm not a trainer, and I don't think the radio is the mm-hmm. place to go through all the detail. But if you get a training book, any of the good training books, then they'll show you how to do that. But it does have to be trained. It's not instinctive in the dog in the way that it is in the cat.
Thanks, Max. Patty in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Patty.
Hi, this is so interesting. My husband and I have different perspectives on dog training. I would say he's sterner than I am, but our dog loves both of us equally.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I was going to say is I think dogs are great therapy, and they're just, you know, For our youngest son, he always liked to read to our current dog. And he and Marcy, he'll read out loud. And I honestly believe she sits on his bed and listens to him. And I don't know, but she sure looks like she does. I don't know if it's just because he's laying down and she likes to cuddle and just lay there, you know, cause she's part golden retriever, or if she just likes the tone of his voice, or, you know, why do dogs do that?
So was it Marcy the dog?
Yeah, she's Marcy the dog.
Yeah, Marcy the golden retriever seems to be listening when her son is reading aloud. Is Marcy listening or just wanting to cuddle?
Listening to words, no. I think although there are one or two people who claim dogs can understand words, and you may be able to train a dog to understand particular words. What most of the science has showed is that dogs don't actually learn words. They'll learn a little bit of a sound of part of a word. But, for example, there's a very interesting demonstration done by Ian Dunbar on television in the UK a while back. You know, you may have heard of Ian Dunbar, a very famous trainer who lives in San Francisco. And he got a whole bunch of owners to tell their dogs to... gave their dogs the usual sit command. You know, these owners had all trained their dogs. Their dogs would all sit on command. You say sit, and the dog sits down. Then he said, I want you to turn your back, put your hands firmly down by your side, and give the command so you don't move at all, and the dog can't see your face. And 9 out of 10 of the dogs did not know what to do because they hadn't learned the word, although their owners thought they had. What they had learned was the whole gestures that the owner and the look on the face of the owner that was happening at the same time as the owner was saying that word. So it wasn't the sound at all. That just was, as far as the dog was concerned, was just kind of some irrelevant detail. What the dog was looking at was, what's my owner doing? What's my owner's arms doing? What's my owner's face doing? Her eyes, nose, mouth, everything. So dogs are just very, very attentive, and they love to watch people. And if there's somebody who they think loves them, then they're even more inclined to do that.
Very sweet. So Marcy was just being loving, not listening to the book being read. What about when you say, do you want to go for a walk, and your dog goes through the roof?
Again, it's very simple. The dog has learned that particular set of things. I mean, it may be the words. I'm not saying it can't be, because some dogs will learn the noises like that. The whole ritual of putting on the coat and the boots and getting the leash down and all that kind of thing, dogs very quickly learn what predicts what, you know. And if those things are always followed by a walk, then and they love walks, so they're bound to get excited at that particular point. But there's been some really fascinating work done in France, which just shows how fixed dogs are in this. Using dogs that are guides for blind people, and even though the blind people can't see what's going on, and the dogs have lived with them for 2 or 3 years, what the dogs do is follow the blind person's face and see which direction it's pointing in, one of their most important cues. Now, the blind person may not be looking in the right direction at all because they can't see. It's expected. But the dogs are so programmed, if you like, to follow the direction of human faces and human eyes that even though, as I say, they've probably been getting pretty misleading information from doing that for years, they'll continue to do it. So that just to show how important human faces and gestures are to dogs.
Patty, thank you for the call. Jack in Kenosha is with us. Hello, Jack.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think that dogs are terrible empaths. And I wanted to give you the example. I've had 3 Goldens. My first Golden came down with cancer.
Jack, dogs are terrible what, did you say?
They're empathic.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. They're empathic, I think. And my first dog had terrible cancer. Are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And he was urinating all over because of the cancer, and I could never catch him. But I was walking him one day and off the leash because he was voice trained. And I began to think, because I talked to the vet about putting him down, and I started to cry. And I was really just full of all this thought of having to put him down. And I looked behind me, and he was about 60 feet away standing next to this building. And I called him. He would not come to me. And he'd never, ever done that before. And I walked towards him, and finally, when I was about 5 feet away, he slunk to me. But after that, he was afraid of me at times. And I know he knew what I was thinking. He'd never acted that way in his whole life.
Yeah. Well, what do you think was happening there, John Bradshaw? Did you hear the story?
I did, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, some of these calls are a little bit distorted at my end, but I did hear that one. It's a very moving story. And dogs are empathetic, I think, or empathic, I think you say, over your side of the Atlantic. They're probably not in quite the way that we might think they are. My interpretation of that story would be that the dog had never seen you in such an emotional state before. And I think you said it was a golden retriever, is that right?
Yes, but he had. I mean, he had, and he had seen me upset before. But he was quite distant from me, too. I mean, he wasn't even walking next to me. When I began to cry, I was thinking about it. But when I began to cry, he was quite a ways from me. But after that, until I put him down, there were times when he kept acting afraid. I'd let him out in the backyard to go to the toilet, and he wouldn't come in easily to me. He was never in 12 years afraid of me like that. It was terrible. It broke my heart.
Yeah, I empathize with you. It is very sad when the relationships break down like that, and especially under those kind of very sad circumstances. I mean, it's difficult to comment without, in detail, having been there. But one of the things that I've noticed, and clinicians have noticed, is that in dogs, which I think you said the dog had cancer, is that right?
Yes,
that mood changes can occur in the dog, which can be very distressing to the owner. My first guess at an explanation for that would be that actually what is going on, it may have been a coincidence that it happened when you first became upset about this. But that what you were seeing was really a breakdown in the dog's mind, which does occur, especially in an older dog who's sick, that their initial attachment kind of goes slightly wrong and gets mixed up, and especially when it's very, very powerful, which, with golden retrievers are among the dogs that form these attachments the strongest. Yeah. Which is why they make such wonderful pets, and it's why so many people love them.
Yes.
But, of course, when it starts to go wrong, it's doubly upsetting.
Jack, thank you so much for the call, and I'm sorry for your loss. John Bradshaw, do dogs show empathy on a regular basis?
Well, I think they feel empathy in the sense that they, in a kind of instinctive way. I mean, we have two kinds of human empathy. We have the kind which is the gut feeling. You see someone crying, you want to cry yourself. You don't think about it. It's not something you can help. It's not something you can stop. And that is a simple biological phenomenon, which we call contagious behavior, which is where behavior in a group of animals or people that are not afraid of one another, that are maybe even fond of one another, certainly relaxed with one another, the behavior will just spread around. And the most trivial example of that is yawning. You know, if you get in a room, somebody starts yawning, and you look around, and everybody's yawning. But it can obviously involve deep emotion, like when you see somebody crying, you want to cry yourself. So that's the kind of emotion I think we share with dogs. Their moods will follow ours. They're very sensitive to our moods in a way that almost no other animals are. And their mood will try to match their mood. Well, they won't try. In the same way that we don't try, we don't have to try. It just happens. Our mood changes because somebody else's mood has changed. The other kind of empathy, which I think dogs don't have, is where we try to put ourselves in somebody else's position. So we might not even be in the same room as the person, but somebody phones up and says, "My mother just died." You feel for them. You can imagine what it's like to be them and that you can share their loss that way, even though you're not necessarily sharing it in a very deep emotional way. You can share it in a cognitive way, a conscious way. And that is where I think all the work that's been done on dogs in the last 10 years or so, and there's been a lot, suggests dogs don't do that, that they don't really understand that we have thoughts. They understand who we are, they understand what we do, but they don't think about our thoughts in the way that we think about other people's thoughts.
We are talking with John Bradshaw. He is Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. He is the author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. And we welcome your questions for him about your relationship with your dog, or any questions you have about why your dog does what your dog does. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you, and it's another edition of All Things Political. Kathleen and her guests will discuss the latest national and international headlines coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking about our dogs with the author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. John Bradshaw, how important is a dog's breed when determining its personality? Do we sometimes overgeneralize about dog breeds and behavior?
Well, I think it's a very easy trap to fall into because you know, we're humans. We rely on vision. That's our main sense. And so the first way we categorize things is by what do they look like. And breeds all look visually distinct. They're bred to look a particular way. There's a breed standard, and breed standard talks about what it should look like, or what color it should be, or how long its hair is, and so on. It's easy for us to think, well, these breeds, therefore behavior and breed kind of go together. Some breeds are, you know, behaviorally very distinct, and they're breeds which have been bred to do something particular. And the main examples is the Border Collie, where you've got an animal that was bred to herd sheep. It wasn't bred to be a companion. That's not to say they can't be very, very fine companions, but they're very alert dogs. They're very active dogs, and they have this modified wolf hunting behavior, which is their herding behavior. In their genes. I think there's no doubt about it. It has to be brought out by training, but it's there in the genes. And so somebody in a city apartment who gets a Border Collie is going to have a tough time giving it enough to do because they're intelligent dogs and they need to work, and they need to work their bodies and they need to work their brains. So some of those things go along with breed, but simply to equate breed and personality together, well, what do you do about crossbreeds? What do you do about the mutt you get from the pound? How are you going to judge its personality? And I think it's much more helpful to look at personality as something which cuts across breeds and crossbreeds and looks in general. So you can get a dog that's outgoing or a dog that's introspective and quiet. You can get a dog that's very dependent. You can get a dog that's a bit more independent and so on in any breed. Pretty much, and apart from these very specific things which are part of a breed's repertoire because that's what it was created for, I think it's much more important to match the personality of the dog, whatever it looks like, to the person who and the lifestyle of the person who is going to own it.
Let's take more calls. Shirley and Prentice is with us. Hello, Shirley.
Thank you. My son, about a month ago, adopted from a rescue society a 3-year-old female Westie. She did something I thought was unusual. She put her 5 toys in her bed, gathered them up and put them in her bed, and then found one of my son's shoes and put that in with the toys, and then stepped back and barked at them. I wonder what she was thinking.
Maybe she just wanted to claim one of those shoes as a toy. John Bradshaw, any ideas?
Yeah, you get all sorts of pieces of behavior which seem really a bit strange, and it's really quite common in dogs which have had a kind of mixed history, and you, of course, if you've got it from a pound, I guess you don't know what that dog's previous life was like. My guess is, I mean, dogs are not very object focused as a general rule. You know, they don't like to collect things in the way that some animals do, in the way that a lot of people, a lot of children do. So this must be a dog with an unusual background, I suspect. And my guess is that in its previous home, it found that somehow that this was something that it could use to reassure itself. Maybe it was a little bit insecure. Clearly, it was eventually given up, and so at some point the dog presumably went through a separation from people, and maybe was feeling anxious and insecure, and found that collecting things together and putting them in its bed somehow calmed it down. And so dogs will do pretty much anything to reassure themselves when they get anxious. They'll try all sorts of different things. And I guess sounds like this dog just found something which is, you know, on the face of it, is pretty harmless, really, unless he starts chewing the shoe, in which case it could be a problem.
You know, when we adopted my Australian Shepherd mix, Lady, from a Humane Society, this is more than 10 years ago, we didn't make the connection that this dog had been an outdoor dog in a rural area before we adopted it. It had never been inside of a house. It had not, they left it outside, and it was not housebroken. It was also terrified of tile flooring. So it wouldn't walk on tile flooring, and we ended up putting some rugs down, you know, through the kitchen and anywhere else there was a hard floor, and that eventually helped her, and that now she will go on the linoleum floor in the kitchen. But it was just the oddest thing, and we don't think of that a dog that had been outside all the time is not going to know what the inside of a house looks like and could be afraid of certain elements.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we come across this kind of thing. I mean, I say I'm not a clinician, but I work very closely with people who run behavior clinics, and we do come across this kind of thing all the time. I mean, clearly the example you've got there is not a serious one. I mean, a dog that simply doesn't want to walk on tile flooring, you can overcome that pretty quickly.
Yes.
And you can avoid it. I think in a way you're probably lucky there to have got, well, an Australian Shepherd. Australian Shepherds are pretty confident dogs by and large, so the fact that it hadn't been indoors before, at least it wasn't scared to ever come in the house. And I've heard of situations where the dog, you know, is scared of houses and scared of household equipment and machines in the house, and is, you know, is very difficult to deal with soon after adoption. So the dog's early history is absolutely crucial. And if you're going to get a dog from a pound, well, yes, you are going to have to work with that dog and work with the experts, if you can find them, to overcome any difficulties of that kind that emerge, in your case fairly straightforwardly.
Yeah.
But it's not always, unfortunately, as straightforward as that.
Terry in Bayside is with us. Hello, Terry. Terry, are you there?
Hello.
Go ahead, Terry.
Hi. I'm a veterinarian, actually, and used to have a border collie named Chelsea that was very smart, as most border collies are, and she had a playmate dog across the street named Annie that unfortunately was hit by a car. And the house that we lived in at that time, and she used to be able to look out, you know, through this, you know, big picture window looking for Annie. And, you know, whenever the word Annie was mentioned, she would go to the picture window as, I guess, a learned response. But one time, it must have been a year or two after Annie was gone, we watched the movie version of the Broadway play Annie. And, of course, you know, hundreds of times through the movie, different characters said the word Annie. And boy, it was almost like torture for her that she would just go to the window, go to the window, go to the window. And I just was wondering if this speaker would, you know, make some comments about that, obviously relating back to Ian Dunbar's experiments. I mean, this wasn't gestures that we were making or, you know, a context that she had seen or heard the word Annie with gestures. It was all on the movie. So should I get some input on that?
Oh boy, is that one tugs at the heartstrings, John Bradshaw?
Well, I didn't catch quite all of that.
So the dog yeah, responded to the word Annie when the dog heard Annie on a movie, on a DVD. And right. It, you know, so that's what it was, jumping and looking out the window at its dear departed a canine friend that lived across the street.
Right, who was called who had been called Annie?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's it's quite possible. I mean, some dogs can learn words. I think what or sounds like that. I don't think they think of them as words, but it's a sound, and it's a specific sound with two syllables and so on. While the majority of dogs don't, there are some that do. I mean, and it's been shown that they can learn several hundred words in the most extreme cases that have been documented anyway. So my guess is that this dog, you know, it does sound reasonable. That dog actually did know the word. I mean, coming off a DVD, that is even more surprising, because the kind of sound equipment, unless your caller has very high-grade hi-fi equipment attached to his TV, the kind of reproduction that we accept as perfectly good from our TVs would not be good enough for a dog, because they hear much higher pitch noises than we do. So in real life, the sound Annie made by a human voice would sound quite different to a dog to the recorded version that we would say, that's a pretty good likeness. The dog will go, well, there's a whole little bunch of stuff missing from that, but I think it's the same. So this is a very smart dog, to make that connection. I think what many people ask me is, can dogs grieve?
Right.
And I think they certainly have the ability to know that something is missing. We know, for example, they can count small numbers. If three dogs disappear and two dogs come back, they know that there's a dog not there. There's a dog missing, that there should be one more. So when a dog goes missing, I'm sure that dogs have some sort of notion that there is something missing. Now, whether they have a mental picture of that dog as he or she used to be running up and down the street or whatever is a difficult one. I don't know. But they do know when things are missing, and if they've learned an association between a word and the appearance of something which is fun. So maybe your caller had said, you know, look, there's Annie, a lot of times, and that was followed by a game. That would pretty much, become very strongly imprinted into the dog's mind. And so it's quite feasible that whenever the word came out, even over a TV speaker, then it would make the association and go to the next stage, which is, let's go to the window and see whether she's there.
Thank you, Terry, for the call. Your last chapter in the book is on the future of our relationship with dogs. And in our last couple of minutes here, can you talk more about what we have to look forward to as we learn more about how dogs think and behave?
Yeah, I think that we need to look very hard at what we're doing with dogs. I think it's perhaps still more of a problem over here in Europe than it is in your country, but I think it's still a problem. We have a system which essentially judges dogs and chooses dogs for breeding, to produce the next generation, based on their looks, based on the standards that are used in the show ring. And a lot of dogs are the product of that, whether they're actually pedigree dogs or whether they're crosses between them. Then we have a whole bunch of dogs that are essentially being born irresponsibly to people who have probably not a great deal of interest in dogs, and a lot of those end up in pounds, some deliberate breeding for fighting and that kind of thing. So certainly in the UK, we see a lot of Staffordshire Bull Terriers and Pit Bulls being given up. We see a lot of greyhounds that have failed on the racetrack being given up and ending up in our pounds. So essentially the pet owner, the person who wants a pet dog, has to pick between those are the only choices they have, really. Now, there's an international movement now, which I'm proud to be part of, but I wouldn't claim to have started it, to persuade breeders to think about the pet market as their number one, and amateur breeders,
right.
Backyard breeders, just homes, people who want to breed dogs as a hobby, thinking about, not about the show ring, just think about pet owners, and let's produce dogs. They may not look great, they may look a bit muddy, but they are ready to be pets.
We have to leave it there. But John Bradshaw, is there a website where people can get more information on this?
The book has a website. It's It's just dogsensebook, all one word, .com.
Thank you very much for being with us.